take the photographs in still frames in your mind. Hanging on a shelf in good health and good time. Tattoos and memories and dead skin on trial. For what it's worth, it was worth all the while. It's something unpredictable, but in the end it's right. I hope you had the time of your life. It's something unpredictable, but in the end it's right. I hope you had the time of your life.
Good morning. Open your Bibles to the book of Ruth. We're going to start a study on the time of your life. And as we dive into this great book, we're going to see some incredible things about how God works in the ordinary. We're going to learn some truths that are really important for us to apply. And we've just finished up our sermon series on work life and had a great time last week giving people a chance to actually feel the sense of being ordained for your purpose in your work life. And over 1,600 of you actually signed commitment cards, and I prayed for you guys, and I told you that I would pray for you, all of you, by name. And so I've been spending a lot of time in prayer this week, and I'll spend some more time in prayer next week. Figure if I can pray for 200 of you a day, I'll be wrapped up in just a few more days. So what's been exciting as I've read those prayer requests is the breadth of people that have committed their work life. Students, junior high, senior high, college students who are saying, I want my school to be my place where I really display Jesus Christ. Stay-at-home parents praying for their kids and their neighborhoods and their connections. People who are working in various venues and jobs around the city, really committing themselves to be salt and light and allow Jesus Christ to work through them. It's been amazing. And for those of you who signed up, you started getting the email devotions. And I had two great devotions this week. The first one was on forgiveness, and the second one was on rest. And one of the things I would love to see developed is I would love to see us develop a plan for devotions that would target students. And some of you guys may have some writing gifts and could write some devotions, and we could start an email ministry to send out devotions to students in their work life and school and stay-at-home parents. So there's just a lot of things that God is going to do through this commitment that we've made to live out our lives 24/7 to the glory of God. Also, really excited about yesterday. Some of you may not be aware, but yesterday we had an oil change for single moms. We just opened it up, advertised in the community, actually got some TV billing, and we changed the oil on 101 cars yesterday for single moms in the community. Great, great deal. I want to thank Steve Berry and his team at Christian Brothers Automotive, who they volunteered their time, they opened up their bays, they did a professional job, and then all of the volunteers from Hill Country Bible Church and Hill Country Bible Church Pflugerville that came out to meet with folks, to help in the process, to wash cars, to change light bulbs, to vacuum cars, and then just to connect with single moms, because we want the single moms in our community to know that they're not forgotten. That we care about them, we want to meet their practical needs, and we want to meet their spiritual needs as well. So what a great day yesterday to be able to minister to the community in that way. And thank you guys, all of you guys, who participated in that. Now, one of the things that I'm learning in the course of my life is that the days of my life, the time of my life, tends to come so rapidly that oftentimes I don't stop and reflect on why I'm here and what the big picture is. I mean, you know, you got Sunday and then got to get all that yard work done, watch the Cowboys. They play at 3 for those of you who are nervous. I've already been informed of that. Got to get all that done, get the kids' homework done, then Monday morning and here we are back at it. And the day goes by so fast and there's so many things going on between work and family and connections and responsibilities and carpooling and sports activities. And then fill up that extra time with all the media noise. You know, we got TV and we got iPods and we've got computers. And it just seems like life is so busy. And very seldom do I have the chance to stop and reflect unless I run into a disturbance. you know, or something in my life, something that's unplanned, something that I'm not anticipating, comes along, boom, you know, disturbance, and then it's time to stop and reflect. Well, I had one of those several weeks ago. Our senior team leader, Bob King, 33-year-old gentleman, he got my son into dirt biking. So, you know, he's got my son Sam out there riding, and so they asked the old man, you know, you need to come along with us. And so on a Sunday afternoon, I agreed to go ride dirt bikes. Now, it's been 30 years since I've been on a dirt bike, and, you know, I think I remember that I was quite good at it, but it's been a long time. So sometimes, you know, the older he gets, the better he was. Well, anyway, I get out there with these guys, and of course, Bob's got a new bike, and it hadn't really been ridden, and it isn't really set up yet, but it's okay. Let's let Tim ride it. So they put me on it, you know, and I'm riding around a little bit and, you know, trying to figure this thing out. And I come up this hill, and I'm faced with a barbed wire fence and a tree. And as I'm looking at that, there are a myriad of options at that moment that I could take. And I chose the one that took me headfirst into the tree and the fence. And actually, the tree was a blessing from God. Because as I was coming face to face with that tree, with my helmet, it was actually slowing down my forward progress into that fence, which was cutting deep gashes into me. And so the tree was actually very providential. But as I started to get up from the bike, you know, the bike is laying there, and I looked down at my arm, and I could see the cuts going up my arm as the barbed wire skipped. And one of those looked pretty bad. I ended up needing 10 stitches, and I thought, well, it's just an arm. You know, I got two of them. I'm out here with the guys, you know. But I bet you I busted up his bike. And I'm not really worried about Bob and his bike. I'm worried about how much it's going to cost me to get this bike fixed. So I started to try to pull the bike out from under the fence. And as I'm pulling the bike out from under the fence, I see blood spatting on the seat. Boom, boom, boom. And I'm thinking, I wonder where that's coming from. And then I feel the pain in my neck. And I have managed to run my neck into this fence. Now, with all the gear covering all my body except my arm and my neck. So I stand up, and Clayton, one of the guys riding with us, the head of Torch Ministry, he walks up and he stops in front of me, and I look at him, and he's just poker-faced. And I have no idea how bad this is, but I know it's bleeding a lot. And so I look at Clayton and I said, how bad is it? And he just stands there, looks at me. Now, in my head, I'm starting to calculate. Okay, if I just cut my carotid artery, I probably have a little less than 30 seconds before I start getting weak in the knees, and about 2 minutes before I'm completely gone. That's if I hang on really tight. And Clayton is just staring at me. And he's waiting, and I'm wondering. Now, my wife has a bunch of friends, and so this is aside from the story. Let me jump over. And by the way, the only reason why I mentioned age is because it's my wife's birthday today, and she happens to be the same age as me. So I'm not going to tell you guys how old she is. But I did give you a little bit of the story earlier, you know, me being 48 and her being however old she is. So anyway, she's got these friends, and you know, my wife's friends tend to analyze things. And so they're discussing this and after the fact, and they're analyzing it, and they're saying, well, did Tim tell you that during those few minutes of panic there that he was thinking of you? Guys, don't ever answer that question, because you can't give the right answer. I tried to explain to her that I'm in a coastal Bermuda field that's a pasture, and it's filled with cow droppings. And the only thing I can think of is I only have a few seconds to figure out where to lay down. Because when they haul my carcass out of this field, I don't want them to be combing cow dung out of my hair. That was the predominant thought in my mind at the moment. While I'm waiting for Clayton to respond. And Clayton's response is, well, let me look at it. And I'm thinking, what have you been doing for the last 20 seconds of the end of my life? Well, needless to say that, you know, God spared my life a couple more centimeters and I would have been probably not living. And so at that point in time, it was not a big deal. We went in, I got 24 stitches. They sewed me up. I'm going to look kind of ugly for a long time, and probably that's not a surprise to most of you. But after the fact, I started reflecting on that. And I thought to myself, what if I would have died in that field? Because from the time of the injury to the time of death would have been just a couple minutes. And what would it have been like for my son to watch them carry me out of the field? Now, here's his experience. Once I'm cut and bleeding, they get me back over and they sit me down. They're trying to wash the wounds out. And he drives up and he takes a look over at me and sees that I'm actually sitting up. And he goes around the field. So a few minutes later, we kind of figure out that I probably need to get stitches. And so I'm getting in the truck and he's pulled up again. I said, hey, Sam, you want to go with me to the hospital? He says, no, Dad, you got it. And he takes off again. But what would have happened had he been there to watch his father die in the field? And this story has a good outcome, but you know what? I've got two families that live in my neighborhood that both go to this church where the kids watch their father die. Not in a traumatic accident, but over time through a long, ugly, painful illness. And how do we process that? And what do we do with that? And where is God in all that? And how do we embrace this concept of God being involved in our lives? When things like that, that we're not expecting to happen, go terribly wrong, and our lives are disrupted, how do we deal with that? What do we do with those things? You see, I'm asking the question this morning, is God still governing in our disrupted world? Is God still governing? Is he still in control when the world around us is disrupted? That's what the book of Ruth begins to address. And if you'll turn to Ruth, the first chapter, starting in verse 1, we're going to look at six verses this morning. It says in verse 1, in the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land, and a man from Bethlehem and Judah, together with his wife and two sons, went to live for a while in the country of Moab. The man's name was Elimelech, his wife's name Naomi, and the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem, Judah, and they went to Moab and lived there. So here's the situation or the setting. They're living in a particular time in history that stands out as one of the most difficult ever to live in. It was a time of complete societal instability. Notice the first phrase. It says, in the days when the judges ruled. Now, if you want to know what life was like under the judges, just turn back to the book preceding, and you're going to see the story of the judges. The story of the judges occurs when Joshua has helped the nation of Israel. They've conquered the land predominantly. They've moved in. They've set up in the land. But it's a time when kind of the Wild West outlaw mentality ruled and reigned. In that time, there are eight guys that God raises up of varying levels of morality, varying levels of leadership, and God uses these guys to deliver the nation of Israel from the lands around them, the tribes around them. And it's a bad old time. It's a time when people are not following the law. It's a time when the priests are corrupt. It's a time when there's no centralized government. It's a time when the clans, the 12 tribes, are fighting each other. It is an ugly, ugly time in history. And what we know from our study of history is that when the institutions and structures of society that are intended to unify and hold people together, when those begin to break down and people lose confidence in those, they do something that's very damaging to themselves and others. It's found in the last verse of the Judges. So if you'll turn back one page, flip back to the last verse of the Judges. In verse 25, it says, "In those days, Israel had no king. Everyone did as he saw fit." In those days, Israel had no king. Everyone did as he saw fit. In other words, everybody became their own king. Everybody made up their own rules. Everybody established their own morality. Everybody established their own views of who God is. And in that kind of a culture, what you have is the worst of a dog-eat-dog society, where everybody is scrapping to get by. When the structures of society fall apart, people resort to their own ideas. You know what? As I look at our culture today, it's not nearly as chaotic as the Judges, but it's got a lot of similarities. Let's just take the government. We take our federal government. Do people have confidence in our government? 67% in a 2007 poll feel like the two-party system, the foundation of our government, is failing. And we've watched it. You know, the Democrats, when they were in power, what did they say? They said, hey, once we get enough, then we'll be able to do something. And they weren't able to do something, and then the Republicans took over, and they said, you know, now that we've got power, we're going to be able to do something, and they didn't do much. And now the Democrats have moved back in, and they're vying to take power back, promising that they're going to do things. And you guys know, I mean, I know, we've seen it, that the partisanism is so strong. The power grabbing is so strong. We don't have confidence. We don't have confidence in where this thing's going from our government standpoint. How many of you guys lay your head down on your pillow at night and you're thinking to yourself, hey, Washington's got it covered? Those people have it figured out. I can sleep soundly tonight because they've got the world under control. And whether it's something that's foreign like the war, or whether it's something that's domestic like Katrina, I mean, it's not a pretty picture. And people have lost confidence and are losing confidence. What about business? I mean, all you have to do is start throwing around a few names like Enron to understand that the average person is not looking to business to save them, to keep them secure. I mean, we've got a lot of concern there. What about our heroes? What about our heroes? You know, our heroes are artists. They've got it figured out. How about our sports figures? I mean, how do you tell your son, this guy is the greatest home run hitter that's ever swung a bat, except we don't know if we can award him the home run championship because he's been using drugs. Has he done it on his own? Is it hard work or is it medication? Which one is it? And we wrestle with those things. And then it comes to the church. We say, do we have confidence in the church? From the televangelist scandals to the abusing of children. And people lose hope. They lose confidence. And what happens when we have a group of people, a generation of people, which I believe is this emerging generation that's coming on the scene, they're losing confidence. So what do you do then? Well, you start making it up. If the government doesn't know, if business doesn't know, if there are no heroes in the world, if the church doesn't know, if mom and dad are living by their wits, what do? You make it up as you go along. I'll make up my own beliefs about God. I'll make up my own morality. I'll make up my own economics. I'll make up my own relationships. I'm going to make it up as I go along. And that's the situation into which this family, Elimelech and Naomi, emerge. That's the world they're living in. And I believe that that's the world that we're living in as well. In addition to the societal instability, they also have huge economic downturn, which really affects them. Notice in the next verse, We're in that same verse. In the days when the judges ruled, there was famine in the land. And a man from Bethlehem in Judah, together with his wife and two sons, went to live for a while in the country of Moab. Now here's what's the irony in the passage. The city name Bethlehem, Beth means house, and Lahem means bread. The name of the city is the house of bread. There is no food in the house of bread. Now they're living in the promised land. They're living in the place of God's blessing. And you know what? It's not raining in Bethlehem, but if you just go down the road a few miles in Moab, they're getting rain. So what do we do about that? How do we deal with that? You know, when people find themselves in difficult economic straits and they're living by their wits, what do they do? Well, what Elimelech does is he says, I'm pursuing the food. And so he's going to leave and he's going to go to Moab and he's going to set up shop there and live there temporarily to see what happens. Now, when Elimelech chooses to go to Moab, three things that he's leaving behind when he goes that are very important to his faith and his family. The first thing that he's leaving behind is he's leaving behind the land of his inheritance. He's leaving behind the land of his inheritance. In other words, when God divided up the land among the nations, he gave specific pieces of land to the family. And in an agrarian culture, that piece of land, that was your livelihood. And when he leaves that, he's leaving behind his land, even though it's not growing much, he's giving up the family business. In addition to that, he's giving up his clan connections. He's going to take his family and move away from those people that are close to him. And he's taking his family into a land of strangers, and he's going to set up shop there. The third thing that he's giving up that's significant is he's moving away from the place where they worship Yahweh, the God of the Bible. And he's moving his people to the land of Moab, where they worship pagan deities. And their worship is pretty gross. Now, if you want to spend a little bit more time studying Moab and what they were like in their history, you can go back to Genesis chapter 19 and see where they came from. Moab was one of the children born to Lot's daughter out of the incest that took place between father and daughter. And the family is just rife with that kind of behavior. And the history is rife with that kind of worship. It's an ugly, ugly mess. He's taken his family into that. Why is he doing that? He's doing that because when everything breaks down, what is the tendency? The tendency is to do what seems right to you. So here's my question. My question is, do I live by God's ways or do I live by my wits? Do I live by God's ways or do I live by my wits? When the society around me starts to go south, do I live by God's ways or do I start making it up as I go along? Now, here's my alarm, okay? Very alarmed about something that I see taking place, and here's my alarm. My alarm is that the Church of Jesus Christ seems to be so impotent to be making a difference in our culture that people view the structure of the Church of Jesus Christ, the organization, the gathering, as irrelevant. You say, well, how do you know that, Tim? Well, let's just look at the trends. In a study that was done in church attendance from 1991 to 2004, over a 13-year period, the number of unchurched people increased 92%. 92%. We went from having 39 million people in the United States who would consider themselves unchurched to 75 million people in the United States in 13 years. In 13 years. Now, who are these folks that are disconnecting from church? You know who they are? They're the youth. They're the youth. Listen to this. 7 in 10 Protestants, ages 18 to 30, both evangelical and mainline, who went to church regularly in high school, said they quit attending by age 23. 34% of those said they had not returned, even sporadically, by age 30. 70%, one 7 out of 10 who go to church in high school regularly, they're part of it in high school, will leave by the time they're 23, and only 34% will return. We're losing a whole generation of people. And what are you left to? What are you left to? To make it up. To make it up. Make it up as you go along. And in my interaction with young people, I see young people all over the place kind of making up their concept of God. Well, here's my vision of God, or here's my view of God, or my God would be this way. And we see people making up their morality, making up their relationships. Why? Because they have lost confidence. They've lost confidence. One of the most important things that you as an individual, that you as a parent can do is not make up your life as you go along. You've got to get in the Word of God on a daily basis and seek His direction for your life. That's the only way that you can ensure that your life is on track. The government's not going to get your life on track. Business not going to get your life on track. Heroes are not going to get your life on track. Even the Church of Jesus Christ in and of itself is not enough to get you back on track. You've got to stay in the Word on a daily basis. And that's the main thing that I tell my 2 college-age kids. Are you having a quiet time? You spending time daily with God? That's the most important thing you can do. Because if you don't, you'll make it up on your own. And there will be a day when you will wake up and wish you didn't. How many here have tried that? There was a point in your life when you tried to do this by yourself. You lived by your wits. You made it up on your own. I've done it. It doesn't work. It doesn't work. Get into the Bible. In addition to that, second thing is our kids need to see us worship. Dads, do your sons see you worship? I mean, there's a lot of things that our youth group can do for these kids, but they can't do what only you can do, dads and moms, and that is show them a living faith, 168 hours a week, 24/7, 365. That's what makes the difference. And so what we're seeing is that there is a movement among the young people to leave and go out on their own and make it up on their own. And that puts them in a really, really dangerous place. So how are we modeling? How are we leading? How are we encouraging? How are we spending our time in the Word? You've got to be in the Word on a daily basis, seeking God's direction for your life. In the midst of the story, we ask the question, is God still governing in our disrupted world? But then what happens when it gets personal? Is God still good in my disrupted life? What happens when the tragedy strikes close to home and it causes me to question the goodness of God? Well, that's where we go in the story next. In verse 3, we see this huge tragedy just shouted into the life of Naomi. It says, now Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died. And she was left with her 2 sons. Just a word on the names. The name Elimelech means God is king. So here's the guy whose parents named him God is king, but it doesn't appear that God is present. He dies. The name Naomi means pleasant one. And we'll look at that more next week as to how that name plays itself out. But now Elimelech dies. He takes his family to Moab, and there he dies. But there's still hope. The passage goes on to say, with the 2 sons, verse 4, they married Moabite women, one named Orpah and the other Ruth. So it appears that things are going better. And it says, after they had lived there about 10 years, both Mahlon and Chilion also died, and Naomi was left without her 2 sons and her husband. We see this tragedy here because not only do her sons die, but they haven't had any kids. And so Naomi is here. Her husband's died. Now her sons have died. Tragedy upon tragedy. She's got these 2 daughter-in-laws. They're both Moabites, which creates some interesting intermarriage issues, interreligious, interfaith issues. But in the midst of that, too, she's left without anybody. Now, what's that going to look like? We'll talk about that next week, what it means for her personally. But it also means something for her as a woman. In their culture, passing on the family name, having a son to inherit the property, having a son to keep the family name alive, was a huge deal, and mothers in particular shouldered the desire and the burden to make that happen. It was very important to them that they would have sons. She doesn't have sons. She doesn't have daughters. She doesn't have anything. And now she's left in this very, very tragic situation. Now you wonder, is God good? Can she trust him? Is her family out of control? Is everything falling apart? Have you been in a situation like that? Where you just look at God and you say, God, how could this have happened to me? How could you let this happen? My life is going in the wrong direction. In the middle of that, there is this little tiny ray of hope, this providence hinted. Notice verse 6. It says, when she heard in Moab that the Lord had come to the aid of his people by providing food for them, Naomi and her daughters-in-law prepared to return home from there. Okay, I got a question for you. Think hard. It's a deep question. How did she know? How did she know that God had come to the aid of his people? Look at the text. When she heard in Moab that the Lord had come to the aid of his people by providing food for them, how did she know that it was God who did that? How'd she know that? You know how she knew it? She believed in providence. She believed in providence. And let me tell you, the doctrine of providence is one of the most important doctrines for everyone to embrace if you're going to survive in this life. Well, you say, well, what is the doctrine of providence? I've given it to you here on your outline. Providence is the activity of God as he guides and governs his created order. It's the activity of God as he guides and governs his created order. Here's what's taking place. They get rain in Bethlehem. The crops start to grow. There's bread again. Naomi is living in Moab, and she hears about it, and guess what Naomi interprets that as? Oh, God's taking care of my people. She takes an ordinary circumstance, and she gives it a supernatural interpretation. In other words, she's willing to see the hand of God at work in her life, which gives her hope to come back, hope to persevere, and ultimately, the story's going to have a pretty good ending. We'll come to that in a minute. Now, here's what you have to know about Ruth. In the book of Ruth, there's never a voice from heaven. Nobody has a vision, and there's no visible miracles. And yet, out of the 85 verses, 23 times, the name of God appears. And 21 of those 23 times, it's coming out of the mouth of the people in the story. You see, the writer of the book of Ruth wants us to understand that the people in the story, they see the hand of God. They believe in the hand of God. In the good and the bad, they believe that God is in control, that he's governing and he's guiding and he's good to his people. And they never face a situation, no matter how tragic, without recognizing that God is involved. And they never face a situation, no matter how good it is, that they don't recognize that God is involved. They see the hand of God. And that's the belief or the doctrine of providence, that no matter what is going on in my life at this moment, I know that God is in control, that God is good, and that God is leading this circumstance in my life toward a conclusion that's going to be positive. Well, let's take a look at that conclusion. Turn to the end of the book. Turn to the end of the book. Two verses, starting in verse 16 of chapter 4. It says, then Naomi took the child. Oh, Naomi's got a child. How did Naomi get a child? I'm not going to tell you. You're either going to have to read the book or come back. Naomi is in Moab with no kids and no possibility of kids. At the end of the story, she's back in Bethlehem with a child. And the passage goes on and says, they laid him on her lap and cared for him. The women living there said, Naomi has a son, and they named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. Whoa! She's got a child, and he's going to be the grandfather of King David. Now, here's what's so amazing about what happens here. She goes from tragedy and pain to being the fulfillment of two incredible miracles. One, with a son, her family line is going to be carried on. So her family is saved, but not only is her family saved, the son that she bears is going to be the grandfather of David, the king who's going to solve the problem of the judges. Remember the last verse? There was no king in Israel. So everyone did what was right in their own eyes, except there's going to be a king in Israel. And you know where that king's going to come from? It's going to come from Naomi's family. Out of the tragedy of Naomi's life, we're going to see the providence of God guide her life to become something that's going to be the salvation of her clan, her family, but not only that, but the salvation of the nation. And that's what providence is all about. To be able to embrace in this moment today that my life is being guided and governed by a sovereign God who is good. And these circumstances right now are part of his divine plan. And so I got to hang in there with him, because he's the kind of God who can be trusted with my life. I can follow him, not living by my wits, but living by his will, because he's got the situation of my life completely under control, whatever that might look like. I want us to take a moment and just bow our heads. As you bow your head and just sit before God, I want you to spend a moment or two just asking yourself the question, have I embraced this doctrine of providence? Do I believe right now, do I believe that God's in control of my world? He's in control of my business, my family, my health, my kids, and that he is shaping my life for my good and his glory. Do you believe that? As we prepare to receive communion, why don't you just continue to meditate on how the cross of Jesus Christ secures our confidence in the providence of God.